En portugués, en neige. Oh. Ok. But, en anglais, c'est?
Snow.
Snow. En French is? En creole, en French, neige. Ok. Ok. Well, that's the end of the show this afternoon. Ok? We have to come again next time. And that's what it is. Stay tuned. Okay, where is he? Oh, I'm not listening to this. We have to listen to this.
Hi, this is Brendan Monk. You're currently listening to WGXC Acro, 90.7 FM, coming to you from Hudson, New York.
I'm Rob Saffer. I create and produce Overlooked, a show for underplayed and overlooked music of all kinds. I'm also a dedicated WGXC listener. I love the other music shows, the news, and the better weather is the best. Because I listen, I pledge. I'm a sustaining supporter. Because community radio matters now more than ever. Go to WGXC.org/donate and donate. Thank you.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, for me, thinking about why supporting WGXC matters, like, yeah, we're here to provide content that we hope you enjoy. I hope you come back for.
Yay.
But also, like, just getting in the studio sometimes and being able to make whatever it is we got to make, you know, not being too concerned about it being perfect, but just being ourselves. I feel like that's therapeutic a lot of times on a Friday after a long week.
For less than 70 cents a day or $20 a month, you could become a WGXC monthly supporter.
Please donate to WGXC to keep Catskill Cabin Getaway and all the other fantastic shows going.
Sustaining support is charged monthly to your credit card or PayPal account at any level you choose. It's a tax-deductible charitable contribution and very easy to cancel at any time. So to make a recurring donation or to make a one-time gift, go to wgxc.org/donate or you can call 518-697-7400. 518-697-7400.
Anyway, if you are listening, you appreciate having different voices on the air than you typically hear. Having young people who have built the radio show literally from the content to the music to how we introduce everything about it. The sound engineering, the tech, every little bit of it is done by young people at the clubhouse.
WGXC has served Greene and Columbia counties in New York for over 11 years, and I'm one of the programmers who started with the creation of the station in 2011. Keep community radio in the community.
Help WGXC meet its goal and keep local, national, and international news broadcasting in Greene and Columbia counties. Thanks so much.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the First Presbyterian Church of Hudson, a faith community open to all. Whether you are single, married, divorced, gay, wealthy, poor, or no habla inglés, if you are just browsing, just woke up, or just got out of jail, it doesn't matter if you work on Wall Street or if you sleep on Wall Street, you belong. We love soccer moms, crying babies, vegans, hipsters, seekers and doubters, tourists and locals. All are welcome. Services held Sunday mornings at 10:45 a.m. You can find us on the web at firstpreshudson.org.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Kirby Crone of Hudson, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to wgxc.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
Take your Wellingtons off, children, and Mammy will tell you a pleasant story.
Good evening. I'm Kevin Factor, and this is Foraging Ahead. Tonight, we're going to be ourselves in the studio. I've got a couple of guests. If I had to give a title to this program, it would be the raconteur, the bon vivant, and the curmudgeon. I have with me a dear old friend from Indiana originally, and the Hudson Valley, Rob Schott. Say hi, Rob.
So nice to be here, Kevin.
And a regular fixture, a titan of intellect, an endless font of stories and information, the Google before Google, Benjamin Hale. Welcome, Benjamin.
Thank you very much for that flattering introduction.
Well, that's, you know, that's the least I could do. It's the least, because you guys are not getting paid. And so, have you written any good books lately?
Yeah. well, I think it's good. I finished... I handed a book in to the publisher about 6 months ago. I need to talk more directly into the microphone. I handed a book into the publisher about 6 months ago, and I'm just waiting to hear back from the editor about it. It's really long, and I was working on it for not continuously, but I wrote the first draft of it about 17 years ago. And so it was, it was actually of all the things that I've ever done, you know, this one,
and you're married.
That's true. Yeah. No, this one project that has consumed more of my total man hours than any other one thing in my life. And I'm kind of,
I should have waited for that quip.
Yeah. No, I have been relieved to have it off of my plate while I'm in this kind of waiting period to see, you know, where it's going to go once the editor gets back to me. But
that's
yeah.
a big deal, though. Congratulations, man.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I mean, when it comes out, it'll probably be, you know, at least a year from now, probably more.
Is that right? Why that long?
Well, the editing process takes a little while, but most of the reason why a book comes out when it does is because the publisher waits for certain times in the book market in order to release certain books, you know.
I feel like the longer you wait for the book market, the smaller the book market is going to be.
So are you like a 4th of July crowd or...?
Well, no, because it's kind of interesting that there are different, it's not a 4th of July crowd because, like...
I'm guessing you're a November novelist.
No, no.
That would
no,
be soon.
Not, no,
I thought Christmas.
What's that? No, no. It'll probably be the spring, which is when they release things that are weirder and riskier.
Really? Why is that?
Because fewer people are buying books. there are two big... bumps in the book market, and those are in the summer and in the late fall, early winter. You know, basically
summer reading and winter reading.
People buying books to read on vacation, and people buying books as Christmas presents. That's those are the two big bumps.
Nice,
yeah.
That sounds like the fresher, funner genre to be coming out for summer reading. I'd be slightly ashamed if I were a winter writer.
Well, winter is it's just like with the movies. When the book industry releases all of their sort of like critical heavy hitters. You know, like they would wait to if like Philip Roth was coming out with a new novel, they would wait until like November or December to release it, or Don DeLillo, or you know, Toni Morrison,
or Benjamin Hale.
Well, you know.
Do you write under your given name?
Are you
Benjamin
Hale
on the cover?
It's not his given name.
Well, I mean, somebody, yeah. No, of course it's my given name.
Oh, is it?
It is, yeah.
Oh.
You know, my birth name.
You sound so disappointed.
I don't know. It's like I thought he had sort of a nom de walking around.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So you've written this, would you call this your magnum opus?
Yeah.
Which is like big work.
Yeah,
big
work. Exactly. Yes, Latin for big work.
The cheap seats.
Yeah. I'd say it's almost an accidental magnum opus.
Ooh,
because
that's a great title.
Yeah.
Sounds
yeah.
like it's definitely magnum.
It's definitely Magnum. I don't know. You know,
it sounds like it was a whole lot of Opus.
It was a whole lot of Opus. Yeah, you know, because it's like, I mean, the draft that I gave the publishing company was like over 1,500 pages.
1,500 pages. Yeah. That was like double spaced, right?
Yeah, it's you know, double spaced 12-point font. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Have you written such a long book before?
No, I wrote a pretty long novel that's nowhere near as long as this one that came out about 10 years ago.
Oh, your first one?
Yeah.
Yeah, which was a marvelous book if you haven't read it.
Have you read it?
Yeah.
No. I was looking forward to the new one for my first read.
It's titled The Evolution of Bruno Littlemore.
Bruno Littlemore.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's
a good title.
It's a raunchy, it's a hilarious, epic, fun-filled, raunchy, humorous novel about a chimpanzee who gains consciousness, becomes an artist.
Well, you know, learns language. You know, learns to speak.
Sort of no. Like flowers for Algernon. No, I think... does he regress? No spoilers.
I'm not going to mansplain Ben's book to him.
Well, the only reason I said that is because of the word consciousness. You know, because I mean, all chimpanzees, at least in my opinion,
now what do you know?
Yeah. No, I mean, like just I teach a whole class about this.
Animal consciousness.
I teach a class. I taught it for 5 times at Bard, and I've taught it 3 times at Columbia now, called Imagining Non-Human Consciousness.
Huh.
This might be a dumb question, but have you ever tried to teach it to a chimpanzee?
I never have, no.
Do you think it could be translatable?
Parts of it, maybe.
So, non-human consciousness.
Yeah.
And
it's a deliberately, provocative phrase. Just even using the phrase non-human consciousness is a little bit of an intentional, you know, jab in the eye of like some people who would take issue with the
Well,
the
I just
concept.
Actually I read a book recently.
Congrats!
Thank you. called Inside of a Dog.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Yeah.
Have you read it?
No.
Oh, it's a book for you, for sure. And yeah. It's a book for our listeners. I don't know the woman who wrote it, mm-hmm. but it's basically like how a dog sees the world. And
right.
There's a theory out there that it seems pretty well supported through observation that that dogs have a... have a rudimentary theory of mind.
Yeah.
Right. And mm-hmm. Rob?
You don't mean one that they follow, but one that they, like, understand.
Like a theory of mind, like, so they often say that dogs are like an adult dog has the intellect of a 3-year-old child. And
can you source that information?
yeah. It's well known, but people know things. But you have a... So if you have like 3-year-olds, right, and you have puppets, right, and they've done this experiment, mm-hmm. And there's one puppet takes a ball and puts the box over the ball, and then the other puppet leaves the room, and then the puppet that remains takes the ball out of the box and puts the box back, and then the other puppet comes back in, and this is all in mm-hmm. in view of the 3-year-olds, and then they ask the 3-year-olds, is this puppet who left the room and came back think that the ball is under the box, right? And 3-year-olds will go no, because they can't put themselves into another being's mind and say, oh, I have information that this puppet doesn't have, right? And so they think, because I know the ball's not under the box, that the puppet is going to know that there's no ball under the box. So, and that's a theory of mind. Mm-hmm. 4-year-olds, human beings, like, universally get it. Oh, mm-hmm. no, I know something that they don't know, and they're going to say that there is a ball under the box. So that's a theory of mind.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like getting molars might have something to do with the appreciating that as a 4-year-old, but not a 3-year-old.
Uh-huh. I don't know. But dogs have, like, they can think what we are thinking.
They certainly can predict what I want or what we want, right?
It's more or less. I mean, it's training. Limited. It's rudimentary.
Yeah. Well, theory of mind is a really difficult thing to test in non-human animals because you can't ask them questions like you can, you know, a three-year-old. And so it's kind of interesting that there's, you know, among psychologists who study animals, there's a lot of controversy about what constitutes theory of mind, how you can demonstrate theory of mind, you know, because some people think some psychologists, I should say, think that like the mirror test is enough.
Being able to recognize yourself.
Right. Being able to recognize yourself in a mirror, you know. Sorry about the and others say no, like mirror recognition is not good enough. Or I was having a really interesting conversation with a friend of mine who's a cognitive psychologist who studies chimpanzees and autistic children, huh. Autistic human children. Mm-hmm. Those are her two specialties, and she was telling me about this another interesting kind of variant on the mirror test, which is to see if someone recognizes, to see if a person recognizes themselves in a video of themselves that was just taken, you know, like a child, you know. And it's really interesting that, you know, children don't pass the mirror test until about like two or something like mm-hmm, that. Mm-hmm. And then with
there's still learning object permanence.
Yeah. And this other study that she was telling me about is you take a video of a kid and then, you know, there's like a sticker on the kid's head or something like that, mm-hmm. you know, and you take a video of this, you know, like a toddler.
Something they know about stuck to their head or they don't know it's
no,
there.
Something they don't know about. Yeah. I'm not sure how they stick it on there without alerting them to it, but they do.
I could figure that out. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The old sticker on the forehead.
And then they take a video of the kid and then they show the kid the video right after that. And recognizing yourself in a video is something that happens much later than recognizing yourself in a mirror. Most kids can't even do it until they're like 5 years old. Even
really?
Yeah.
That's why you can't have an Instagram account until you're five now.
Right. Yeah, because like it's a much freakier thing. Like, you know, the kind of weirdly discombobulating experience that you get if you ever happen to see yourself on like the security camera footage of like you're standing in line at a gas station or something like
that.
Oh,
yeah, yeah.
And you look up and you're like, whoa, that's, you know.
And the police show it to you and you're like, right, totally, it's not me. Right. I don't know. It just looks like me, but it's not me.
Right.
I have an alibi.
Yeah. You know, but the kids, you know, she said that apparently the kinds of things that kids say when you are talking to them after showing them the video of themselves from like just like a minute ago, it's just this weird smorgasbord of bizarre things the kids say. Like they say things like, why is she wearing my shirt? You know, because they just don't get it, you know, because she said that there's another level of self-recognition and, you know, theory of mind, which has to do with time. And then so the first thing you realize when you're a kid is that my reflection is me. Like,
right.
You know? And then the next thing you realize is that there is a me that is consistent somewhat through time. Like that is the me of a couple minutes ago, and there will be another me of like, you know, in a couple of minutes, and it's the same person.
That must be a huge relief to realize that.
I'm gonna wrap my head around this.
Yeah, because before about 4.5-5 years old, kids live in just an eternal present where your consciousness is always of that moment.
Right.
You know?
I've been accused of
that's
that.
Where I want a vacation.
Yeah, with the eternal present.
Yeah, some 4-year-old's experience. Yeah.
Right, and then at about 4.5-5 years old, you kind of gain an understanding of time.
Huh. I wonder if there's a relationship between that sort of childish consciousness and the consciousness of people with dementia who are on their way out.
I bet there's something interesting to you know, look into there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it has to do with, they say that, you know, people who are like, people who have dementia or Alzheimer's who can't remember anything, but they still remember things from their very earliest childhood.
Yeah, yeah. The deeper, the older the memories. Yeah.
Right.
Certainly. Yeah.
Yeah.
They start looping on them.
Right.
Right. And, yeah. And uh-huh. So like
the pay toilet in Coney Island, for example.
Oh, I'm gonna be yeah, screaming at my caretakers for a dime.
You know, yeah, to,
long after.
Yeah, yeah to, long, to use the bathroom at Nathan's.
Long
yeah,
after, yeah. Long after we've abandoned paper money. You know, they're gonna be, what's this dime you're talking
right.
about?
Oh, by the way, Alexandra Horowitz is the person who wrote that book about dogs that you just finished reading, Inside a Dog.
Alexandra Horowitz.
Yeah, I just yes. wanted her to get her you know, proper
yeah, it's a
accreditation on the radio.
Yeah, well, that's it. You're a yeah. That's from one author to another. Yeah, and it's a marvelous book. Mm-hmm. I recommend it. And I don't know her. I have no. I'm. She seems like a nice person. She likes animals.
Yeah.
Right?
She wrote a good book about dogs.
Sure. It's called Inside of a Dog, which I love because
yeah,
it you know where it's from, right?
Sounds like Heart of a Dog with Gogol Story is what it reminds me
no,
of.
No. It's from an old Groucho Marx saying, mm-hmm. which is like, outside of a dog, a book is a man's best friend. Inside of a dog, it's too dark to read.
Yeah, my grandfather would always, grandmother would always say, you know, if it was really dark, it's as dark as the inside of a horse. Is that like an archy expression?
Is it?
It is. Yeah. It?
And someone knew that.
Yeah. Well, you know the trapper trader Jim Bridger.
I don't.
Yeah. No.
He was one of my favorite trapper traders when I was a kid.
Wait.
Yeah.
Wait. There's more than one.
Yeah, like, you know, Daniel Boone, Kit Carson, you know.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, yeah. The like frontiersman, a... you know. Okay. Like, this is like the 1830s, you know.
Did he have a signature piece of clothing like the mm-hmm. coonskin hat or anything like this?
No, he didn't have anything like that, but, you
probably
know.
How he escaped my notice.
Right. You know, I mean, I don't know why I had this weird Jim Bridger obsession when I was a kid, but, well, for one thing, Jim Bridger.
It probably wasn't the weirdest.
No, it wasn't. No, because, well, Jim Bridger, you know, first white man to lay eyes on the Great Salt Lake, you know, he was an explorer. Mm-hmm. But there was one particular part of Jim Bridger's biography that always really impressed me, like as a, you know, 8-year old, which is that he you know, one night he was stuck in a blizzard and he had no option but to kill his horse and, you know, scoop out some of the guts and get inside and spend the night in the horse.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's what you have to do when you're
there's
a frontiersman.
There's a great poem by Galway Kinnell. I don't know if you ever read that.
About sleeping in a horse?
No, in a bear.
Oh, wow.
It was yeah. this.
That's way harder because a horse is way easier to kill.
Well, this was the thing. It's the poem. The poem was actually I lost a friend over this poem. The poem is about, it's beautiful. Galway Kinnell is one of my favorite poets. Uh-huh. And the gist of it is this guy's tracking a bear, right? And mm-hmm. he had sort of sharpened these bones and put fat and tallow around it. And so the bear would eat it, mm-hmm. but it had and he would eat it and gobble it down. And it had these sharpened points inside it, and it would just rip the bear out from the inside. But then you have to track the bear. So he was looking for bloody scat, and he's going mm-hmm. through the frozen wilderness, and there's a point where he has to get to the bear or he's going to die. Mm-hmm. And he gets to the bear,
wow.
and then he slices the bear open, and the bear's sort of still breathing in the steam. It's just beautiful imagery, violent, mm-hmm. but, like, just, and he crawls inside, and it's, you know, about life and the, you know, uh-huh. the artist's dedication and journey and how you have to commit to things and everything like mm-hmm. that. And I had this friend who I won't mention because I don't really talk to him anymore.
Wait, the poem is called Tracking the Bear?
No, it's called The Bear.
Okay.
It's called The Bear. Fabulous poem by Galway Kinnell. Mm-hmm. And we read it in poetry class, and I was just like, oh, my God, this is the best, you know. Like, and he's like, yeah, no, I think I could totally about communism. and like, I hit him.
what did he think it was like a metaphor about communism?
He thought it was a metaphor
somehow.
For communism because he was an idiot.
He was thinking of the Smurfs.
he was just an idiot.
If it were a metaphor for communism, would it change the way you feel about it?
I would actually I would look him up and apologize.
Nah, not him. The poem.
Oh, the poem? It's not. You know,
but if.
just like The Wasteland is not about Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It is not. I had an argument. Another.
Well, I mean, it was written before Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, you teach literature. I kind of teach English to people. Sometimes there are wrong answers.
Yeah, No, I mean, yes, The Wasteland is not about Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Good example.
So while we're taking a little trip through history, I want to segue to this bizarre dream I had and play a little song that I woke up.
Great.
That sounds. I can't wait.
Yeah, you say that now. So I was watching the hearings, right? The January 6th hearings, right? And I just. That the video of Josh Hawley touched me deeply in ways, and mm-hmm. So I had a dream.
The video of him running away from
I think it brought me more joy than really almost anything other than the love of a very fine woman that I have. But like recently, I had a dream about Josh Hawley, and we were at this party. And I was trying to convince him that he should just like get out of politics and become and join a monastery someplace and really just sort of like learn about himself. And I just about had him convinced. And then I woke up, but I woke up and I had this song in my head, and I'm like, oh, why is this song in my head? And it's an old song. It's a song, that I learned the song because I had to, I got to go back a little further. So in when I was in 11th grade in high school, I missed the Civil War exam. Mm-hmm. Right. So I missed the Civil War exam, and Dr. Hartman, and I was a terrible student. I don't know how. I was in honors classes because I was, I could breathe through my nose, but other than that, I was a terrible student. So I missed the Civil War exam, and Dr. Hartman let me take it in the library in class when I got back. So I took it in the library, and it occurred to me, I know nothing about any of these questions. It also occurred to me, oh, there's an encyclopedia. I'm just going to go over and just like look up the mm-hmm. stuff in the encyclopedia. I'll learn it that way.
It's just an obvious choice.
Just a little bit before I take the exam, mm-hmm. And so I got the encyclopedias out, and I'm killing the test, right?
Wait, there was no one watching you? Like, there wasn't a librarian?
This was like the 80s. Like, we were pretty much on our own.
Yeah,
like,
so you just had one staff.
Like we had an open campus and, right, like, a student smoking lounge.
Right. Like, so you just had, like, the test and then an encyclopedia
Bunch of encyclopedias. Oh, okay. A couple. I mean, I didn't just want to rely on one
source.
So you
were just looking up the answers one by one.
I was looking up the answers on the encyclopedia. Yeah.
Right.
Which, I was actually learning a lot about the Civil War. It turned out actually it was kind of cool. Like, the whole Siege of Vicksburg. Actually, I was running out of time because I got really into the Siege of Vicksburg, and it was really only two questions, mm-hmm. and there were multiple choice. Right. So of course, Dr. Hartman comes in and to check on me, mm-hmm. and he kind of looks down and he says, and I think he said, "What the heck are you doing?" and I just looked at him like, I didn't know some of this stuff, so I thought I'd look it up.
It's valid.
And he's like, he took it with him. He wrote F on the paper, mm-hmm. and which I thought was fair. mm-hmm. But then he also was like, "This kid's gonna fail the class." So he's like, "I tell you what," because he knew I played the banjo, right? And he said, "I tell you what, you come in and you sing Civil War songs on your banjo." And I'll pass you for the test.
Wow, that's where it started.
So he took out, he's like, "You're going to pay for this in abject humiliation," right? But fortunately, I was like in honors classes, and I was such a screw-up at this point. I was maybe not terrifying, but none of those kids were going to give me a hard time. None of them were going to. So I took my banjo in, and of course, I learned a bunch of Civil War songs, which are all kind of the same. The Bonnie Blue Flag, the Yellow Rose of Texas, When Johnny Comes Marching Home, and Lincoln and Liberty 2, and a bunch of these songs. And one of the songs I learned was not a Civil War song, but they didn't care, and I just figured, like, it's a song about a war, right? And the song is The Battleship of Maine, which is the song that was in my head when I woke up from that dream about Josh Hawley. Hmm. See how I came all the way around, mm-hmm. came back to that. Yeah. So this Battleship of Maine was in my head, and I'm like, I haven't thought of this song for 40 years, right? 40 years since I mm-hmm. had to play it in front of Dr. Hartman's 11th grade honors history class, U.S. history. And I'm like, why? And you know what? I'm going to play that now, and I'm going to have – you guys can answer that question yourselves. Oh, and one more little note is actually my good friend Kim Seeger's father – Mike Seeger, a very famous folk artist and musician, was the one who recorded this song that my dad learned it from the album, who then taught it to me.
Huh.
So there's lots of layers here. But this is The Battleship of Maine by the New Lost City Ramblers.
Here's a song that... about which I've said everything that there is to be said, which is the Battleship of Maine. We started singing this before there was a war. We've been singing it so long that we're tired of the song and the war. And we'll stick with it for a while and see what happens next. I saw coming, I dropped my gun and run. It was all about that battleship, man. Now why are you running? Are you afraid to die? The reason I am running is because I cannot fly. It was all about that battleship, man. At war with that great nation, Spain. When I get back to Spain, I'm gonna honor my name. It was all about that battleship, man.
Yeah, and that's basically why. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
It sounds to me that song is about the Spanish-American War and not the Civil War.
No, I told you that.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I said it was
that
not
was
about
the outlier.
It was the outlier.
Sorry. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't catch that.
No, it's okay. You weren't the only one not paying attention. So, yeah, that was my bit. How do you think the January 6th hearings are gonna like
go
end? like do you like? I mean, you're originally from Arkansas.
Well, my family is,
and you are originally Rob from Indiana.
Originally, actually, I'm from Rhode Island, which makes me sound smarter. But yeah, I grew up in Indiana.
You grew up in Indiana, so uh-huh. you must know a lot of like people who. Support, you know, what's his name?
The other side.
The other uh-huh. side.
Well, I mean, you don't have to go to Indiana and Arkansas to find.
No, you can just drive north on
Trump
9G.
Supporters.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's yeah. true. Yeah.
Like they're all over the place here too.
Yeah, no, that's true.
That may well be, but if you threw a dart at a map, you'd probably hit a few more back out.
Right.
Yeah, that's true. Do you have any of them in your family?
No. If I do, there's no one who's, like, vocal about it. Right. Sort of like religion in my family. I grew up Catholic. We went to church every Sunday, but no one cared that much, you know. They didn't tell me I'd done stuff wrong based on what they heard in church. So same with maybe the politics in my family. If anyone's out there, they're keeping it on the down low.
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't. I have an aunt who's married to a Republican, a very moderate Republican that I actually haven't talked to the guy ever since, the trouble started. So I'm not sure exactly where he stands, but, but everyone else in my family, they're actually very committed Democrats. They're very, like, you know, my uncle was in politics. He ran for office a few times.
And, oh.
Yeah, like, they're very involved in Democratic Arkansas politics. They're huh. pretty, for a while, they were pretty close to the Clintons.
Oh.
Like, I mean, before, when he was, yeah, like, before he was president, mm-hmm. like, going pretty far back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, we have the opposite problem, and where I now live in Berkeley, California, there's really just not a Trumper to be found, and the homogeny of political views, although it agrees with my tendencies, doesn't inspire much thought. There's sort of you're living among the choir.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I know.
But that's why people are on Facebook, right? To peek through to the other side.
Right, to feed each other whatever their specific flavor of misinformation is.
And madden someone peripherally pretty regularly.
You see, this is where a theory of mind, from my point of view, fails. Like, I cannot get into somebody else's head to think about, like, how can you think this? You know, it's hard. Help me understand. Mm-hmm.
That's so interesting. I was thinking about that recently for some reason, just as something that's changed in me as I've gotten a little older and started to listen really carefully and, like, look at people in such a way that invites them being genuine back at you and just being open and trying to really hear, like, what's cool about farming bees? What's cool about putting out fires or doing drugs or surfing or whatever their thing is?
Yeah.
If you're willing to listen, it can be pretty cool, even though it's not my thing.
I mean, if people meet each other in person, like, you know this guy. My former landlord, Chris, I'm blanking on his last name.
It's okay, you don't need to mention his last name. Yeah.
he's dead, so, you know, I can't.
To hell with him.
Yeah, no, yeah. But I can't remember his last name the moment. But anyway, like, he was my landlord for a couple of years, and then we bought the house from him.
Oh, yeah. Nice
guy. Yeah, because it was a long story, but it was at the beginning of the pandemic, and he wanted to get rid of the house, and he'd been trying to sell it for years, and we sold him the house. Anyhow, the guy was like, he was an ideal landlord. Like, he was really easy to deal with.
Oh,
he was
that's nice.
Very, like, you know, just chill about everything. If anything in the house ever broke, he would just fix it immediately. And I really liked the guy, you know. Like, I felt like I had a very positive theory of mind kind of feedback loop with this particular guy. And then we bought the house from him, and then he died of a heart attack 2 weeks later. Just a random, you know, act of God. And he was like in his mid-50s and totally in good health. It was like, it was a really unexpected event. And it was really strange. And it was also just odd that he died right after we, you know, closed on the house. But then just out of curiosity, I looked him up on Facebook just to see, like, sometimes when somebody, you know, young dies on Facebook, it's kind of an interesting thing to see, you know, like all of the messages, you know what I mean?
Sure, yeah. Oh,
yeah.
You know, and so I looked him up on Facebook out of that curiosity, but then, like, everything that he posted up until he died was just Trump QAnon craziness.
Oh, my God.
I had no idea, you know.
And it's good. It's good that you did have no idea.
Yeah.
Right? that there's this whole alternate world that people inhabit that I don't know that they would have inhabited it. I mean, it didn't exist 20 years ago.
If
right?
you knew that, you couldn't have seen through it. To have
it would have been
cool
difficult
relationship with this guy. It's funny what stops us.
Right.
No, that's a valuable lesson. It's the parable of the QAnon landlord.
Yeah. Like the parable of the sower, the parable of the, you know, the good Samaritan.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny. You like people, and then you assume because you like them for whatever reason you do that you are like that you are similar. And I had this one class, a leave replacement of special ed kids in the district that I work in, and they're kind of, you know, rural people, you know, rural people.
I met them.
And and they were, you know, they were kids. They're young people. And, like, I'm enthusiastic about any sort of thinking and learning. And I'm curious. And, like you, Rob, I mean, you might not recognize this in me, but I, too, am. Like, what are you interested in? And, like, anything to get you, like, let's talk about that. Oh, what do you find interesting in that? And tell me about that. And people see that you're valuing who they are and by, you know, what they are. So these kids were, we were talking about something or other, and they're talking about their guns, and they go, so like, what kind of guns do you have, Mr. Factor? Like, they just assumed, because they kind of like liked me, because
you're a role model, yes,
that I had not just like a gun, but multiple guns. That I would have guns. And it hit me. And I was like, wow, you have no idea who I am. I mean, I like that. You know, you know who I am enough. You know that I care. But, like, I don't have any guns. And I wasn't going to, like, launch into some screed about guns and everything like that. Because I, totally respect hunting and all that. But, you know.
That brings to mind one of my favorite lines from Wayne's World. I don't have a gun, let alone enough guns to necessitate an entire gun rack.
Well, I'm curious, if you had known that about your landlord before your landlord passed away, would you have wanted to like ask about it and figure it out, or would it felt that might have felt off, you know, too close to me? Yeah. Like maybe that was off limits.
You know, at the time, because this was 2020, you know, this is 2 years ago, and Trump is still in office. I think it would have absolutely changed my relationship with him if I'd known that. You know, like I would have been really creeped out by it. But ever since you know, Biden took office and Trump finally left, and also since, you know, Twitter kind of muzzled him. I've just like, you know, crazy Trumpers and QAnoners, you know, they don't scare me in the same way anymore. You know, like it's like they've been a little defanged. Like I don't, you know, I would be disturbed during the Trump years. Like if I saw somebody walk into a, you know, a restaurant wearing a MAGA hat, I would feel kind of disturbed. It would you know, freak me out. The effect was almost like seeing somebody walk into a public building wearing a, you know, Nazi armband, like a swastika or something. It was really, that's not the way that it's been since January of 2021. You know, like there was this thing that happened to me where I was just like addictively glued to the news for about five years, ever since he came down from the escalator up until the Biden was sworn in. I just couldn't keep from looking at the news on my phone like 20 times a day.
Yeah.
And it was just like in this crazy, you know, hell. And no, it was worse.
It was like this white noise in the background for 4 years.
That truly sounds terrifying. Place to be stuck for 5 years.
Oh, it was awful. Yeah. And then as soon as Biden was sworn in, like the actual moment, you know, I was like, all right, I'm checking out. Like these days, I don't even know the name of the Secretary of Education. You know, it's like, that's the way it's supposed
to
be.
They'll take care of this.
Exactly.
I know it's not DeVos.
Yeah.
Well, that reminds me, though, when Obama was sworn in and we all walked away from the inauguration speech and like, okay,
our work is done
thing.
Here.
It's good. Yeah. Right. We're all good now.
And no, you got to hand it to the fanatics, man. They are fanatical.
Tenacious, if nothing else.
Well, that's, yeah, fanatics are tenacious. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They should be tenatics.
Stick-to-itiveness.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. You know, if first you're, you know, like, bat crap crazy idea doesn't work,
wrong
just
platform
keep
yeah.
going, you know, just keep up, you know. And if you just sit on that street corner with your bullhorn long enough, you know, the world will end, you know.
Coming for
you, because someday, right, like the world, you know, end is nigh at some point. One of those guys is going to be right.
Well, depending on your definition of nigh, maybe they're all right.
Yeah, how do you define nigh, Kevin?
It's too hot. It's too hot for such deep thinking. But no, I had a student that I tutored. He was like the sweetest kid. He had leukemia, and he couldn't go to school. This was just before the pandemic, and for like 2 years I worked with this kid, and he owned like every book that Trump, heavy quotes, wrote.
Yeah.
He had...
But air quotes don't work on the radio.
Yeah. No, they don't.
I'm seeing air quotes.
Yeah. He had everything he had every bit of, like, Trump swag you could imagine. I mean, everything. And So, because he had leukemia, right? And they did the sort of Make-A-Wish Foundation, right? And he got to make a wish. And his wish was to meet Donald Trump. And there was a big picture of him in the Oval Office with his whole family and, like, mm-hmm. Donald Trump. And him hugging Donald Trump and Donald in his wheelchair, and Donald Trump hugging him in his wheelchair. And he could do a great Donald Trump imitation. And but he was like, he was a wonderful student, you know, he was a super sweet kid. But it was just like his family, there was just such anger in mm-hmm. his family at what they felt they were due. And I mean, the dad was like a, he worked on the road crews, you know, he had a good union job. In another era, he would have been a Democrat, you mm-hmm. know, before the Democrats just abandoned, you know, the working class. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, I don't know enough to really go too deep into that, but it's pretty apparent that, you know, people who voted for Bernie Sanders and or Obama, like, voted for Trump because
a lot of them
did. And, but these people were like, you know, Fox News watching all it, and they were, I found myself really struggling, like, because these people were so full of hate, but this kid was so amazing and beautiful. And I remember teaching, I'm getting actually kind of choked up thinking about him. We were doing, labor mm-hmm. theories and Marx. And we went to this. And the nice thing about tutoring is, like, I can go as deep into something as I want to, with a kid if they're willing to go. So we're talking about labor's value, Marx's theory of value-added labor, which is, uh-huh. you know, you're familiar with it?
As my wife would say, not really.
Okay. So an employer is not going to pay you your full value as a laborer because he needs to make a profit, right?
Gotcha.
So you are, by definition, in this system, paid less than your worth, right? And the owner or the management takes that value as for themselves, right? And which is, you know, it's kind of interesting concept. We don't mm-hmm. really think
sort of
about
foundational.
It. What? It's very foundational, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about labor, you know, production, capitalism, you know, what, you uh-huh. know, and it's like, what do you think of the Marxist theory? And he's like, oh, absolutely, absolutely. And he started talking about it a little bit, and I'm like, you know what I think would be fun? And, like, I would like you for your homework to make a big poster of, like, Marxists for Trump.
Hanging in the front yard.
And he was like, yeah, Marxists for Trump. And like, over the weekend, he did it. And there was this huge, he had this huge poster, like, Marxists for Trump with his theory of the value-added labor. And, mm-hmm. And yeah, it's possible to, you know, to bridge those divides. But it's hard, like you said, Rob, it's hard to penetrate it if that's the first thing you see, because everybody gets their hackles up.
Yeah,
right?
And both of you have examples of times where you met someone you really found a lot of value in and, mm-hmm. and just couldn't or had to or couldn't or didn't know.
Yeah.
But what if you get through it?
Yeah, well, but I think I really do think that if people were, you know, if when people meet each other in person, when they can talk to each other face to face, that you know, it's it prevents this crazy, you know, extremism and radicalism. I mean, I'm not the first person in the world to say this, but, like, you know, that social media has just, you know, made people live in different abstract realms where they just get whipped into this, you know, frenzy by algorithms that direct their attention toward more and more extreme content because, you know, that's the way that these algorithms work, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Sure, yeah. Keep you watching.
Keep you watching, keep you engaged. No, it's tragic. So what are you going to do about it, Ben?
Well, I am not on social media. I boycott all social media.
Really?
Yeah, I have for the
that's
last...
You know, that's why I don't know when your birthday is.
Yeah, well, and also, no, no, because, yeah, like, I got off of Twitter in 2015.
I was never on Twitter.
Just... Yeah, okay. Well, I just, so...
Ben was off Twitter before Twitter was cool.
Yeah. No, no, I was off Twitter before Twitter was cool, and then I was on Twitter, and then I got off of Twitter. But no, I mean, like, I got on Twitter because, you know, back when my book came out in 2011, the publisher was like, you know, everybody's got to have a Twitter account. Like, every writer just has to participate in this. And I was like, all right. But I was never very good at it, and I
wrote an 1,100-page novel. You're going to, like... You're gonna do Twitter?
1500.
Like, that's hilarious.
Well, yeah, no, because I did it a little bit, but I wasn't very good at it, and you know, like, my sense of humor just didn't translate to Twitter very well. And,
well,
you know,
no comment.
So, it's always funny to me. You know, yeah. I don't think that I always think my jokes are funny. But anyway, no,
I often think your jokes are funny.
Yeah,
but Ben. We only have a little bit of time left.
Uh-huh.
And but it occurred to me as we were talking, and you mentioned your book again. We've come full circle.
Yeah.
I have no idea what your book is about. Like, what is your book about? We just know the length of it. Uh-huh. We know the work that you put in.
Yeah.
We know
that it's Magnum.
It's not your first or second book.
Yeah.
It's your second novel,
second published novel.
And then shortly after that one, the one that you wrote before you finished this one is probably going to come out as well. But let's just talk about the one that is going to be coming out in a theater near you.
Yeah, to a theater near you.
And somewhere in a month.
At some point in the next couple years. Yeah, probably.
It's going to be, I think, but we're gonna generate demand from this radio show. And people are going to start calling your publisher. Who's your publisher?
Simon & Schuster.
Get on the horn, say, hey, when is the next Benjamin Hale magnum opus coming out?
I know, I'm really patient. I'm in no hurry.
I am in a hurry.
Okay.
I don't know how much time I have left. Well, so, I'm in my mid-50s. I could die of a heart attack anytime.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. Well, I mean, anybody could get hit by a bus tomorrow. You know, it doesn't have anything to do with, you know.
When your book comes out.
Exactly. Well, I would like to be alive
for
it.
So what is you know, in... give me a good couple of tweets on
the
book.
Okay, yeah, like the general elevator pitch, you know. So it's set in a made-up country, an island in the Caribbean, and half of the book takes place in the 18th century, and the other half of the book takes place in the 1990s. And part of it, and it goes back and forth between the two stories happening on the two different timelines, but the first half is very, very loosely based on a slave rebellion that happened in Jamaica in 1761, and then the second half of
1761,
yeah, and then the other half of the book, the one that's set in the 90s, is very loosely based on something that happened in Suriname in the 80s, which is that it has to do with bauxite mining. Bauxite is the main ingredient of aluminum. Like, that's what you smelt to get aluminum.
Sure.
And the Caribbean and in Central and South America is very – the soil is very rich with it because all of those places are very – they're new land, you know. Bauxite is the stuff that kind of eventually turns into coal. It's plant matter that turns into dirt.
Coal.
And that's what you turn into aluminum.
So it accretes as these islands accrete and the new soil.
Exactly. Yeah. It's new soil. Yeah.
I thought peat was turned into coal.
Well, I'm not a geologist, and I'm starting
perhaps
to speak out of my ass, but you know, yeah. but it's the same.
This is the forum for that.
Yeah. Okay. Oh wait, I just said like wait. I can say that, can't I? I could be talking about a donkey. Okay, but so anyway, like there's a lot of bauxite mining in the Caribbean, but in order to turn bauxite into aluminum, you need an enormous amount of electricity, and there are no cheap sources of electricity in the Caribbean. That's why power is really expensive all over the Caribbean islands.
Huh.
And in this one particular place in Suriname, they the Alcoa company realized that the geography was perfect for a hydroelectric plant, which would require a dam, and they built the plant and the dam, which created a reservoir which displaced a whole bunch of indigenous people living in the middle of nowhere in the rainforest in Suriname.
Well, I mean, it was the middle of nowhere, but it was somewhere to them.
Well, certainly it was somewhere to them, yeah. So it was a very remote place, I'll say.
For people who weren't living there.
Right, exactly. Yeah. For people,
well, people who were living there.
For people who were living there,
it was home.
Yeah, and as happens, every time, you know, somebody wants to build a reservoir on top of your house, as the same thing happened at the Ashokan Dam back when they built it in the 1920s.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, the people that live there get mad about it.
People are unreasonable, you know.
Fair warning.
I mean, just because, you know, you're like, oh, my house. Well, there's this large company that's going to make me lots and lots of money. Come right. on. Like, yeah. Don't be so selfish.
Don't you realize how cool it's going to be for us to see a steeple coming out of the water in our boats?
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Throw
Which
us
you
a
can
bone.
In Ashokan, right?
Yeah. Sometimes.
But anyway, the second half of the book is about an anthropologist who is studying the people that are about to get displaced by the reservoir, who is trying to make the hydroelectric plant not get built. And that's kind of what the struggle of the other part of the book is about.
Huh.
Yeah.
I have two questions about your book quickly.
Yeah.
One, are there vampires?
No.
No vampires.
But there are zombies.
Oh, yes. All right. And second question,
traditional
what's
zombies.
What's the name of the island that you made up in the Caribbean?
It's called Jubilee.
Nice.
Yeah.
Huh.
I thought it was a plausible name for a British colony in the Caribbean.
I recognize Jubilee as the name you give to like a 50th anniversary of priesthood for a priest who's been a priest for 50 years. It's
yeah.
say their 50th and, Jubilee.
Or, uh-huh. or a queen who's reigned for a very long time.
Right.
Well, Jubilee like, is initially...
Like, didn't Queen Elizabeth just have her 75th Golden Jubilee? 75 years on the throne, the longest sitting English monarch?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know. It's about time she stood up.
Shout out to QE2.
Shout out Queen Elizabeth.
Shout out to QE2.
Yeah. And look, and Queen Elizabeth, look, you know, you should join our pledge drive and 518-697-7400, Queen Elizabeth, you know, I'm talking to you. Like, get out that Diamond Jubilee credit card. And
Queen Elizabeth
make a sustaining pledge to WGXE.
Yeah. You know that only she can legally eat the swans in England?
She's the only one who can legally eat swans.
In England, yeah. The English swans.
I'm in trouble.
Yeah. No, it's a really funny a bit of like English common law that like goes back to the Tudor period. Apparently it was a problem back then.
Swan poachers.
Yeah.
that's a job. I'm going to put that on my next resume. Well, my gosh, Ben and Rob, it was so fun for me having you guys on and just hanging out and talking in this little sweat box we got in the Hudson studio.
Pleasure doing business with you.
A pleasure being in the sweat box.
Yeah, it's
Is it Bridge Over River Kwai where they like throw you in the box? Yeah.
Oh, I thought.
It's some
that Simon and Garfunkel song.
No, just because they whistle doesn't make
Lack
it Simon and Garfunkel.
Yeah.
No, there's some like a classic, you know, prisoner of war like camp movie.
Sure. And the theme is whistled, right?
Yeah.
I could whistle it, but that probably doesn't translate well.
But I got the perfect outro for your book.
Oh, great.
And here we go, little Warren Zevon. There's no zombies. Everybody, y'all have a great night. Thanks for listening.
I went home with a waitress the way I always do. How was I to know she was with the Russians too? Gambling in Havana, I took a little risk. Send lawyers, guns, and money. Dad, get me out of this.
blind bystander. Somehow I got stuck between a rock and a hard place, and I'm down on my luck. Yes, I'm down.